This is an ABC podcast.
This House last night passed the superannuation guarantee levy. In doing so, it has entrenched in legislation a great reform which will be of great benefit to coming generations of Australians.
No prizes for recognising the voice. What you might not realise is that super, in its modern form, that is compulsory superannuation with mandatory contributions from the employer, is 30 years old. It began in July 1992. Hello, I'm Richard Ady. This is The Money. Big birthdays prompt reflection and market change, and it's the same this time. Brendan Coates is Economic Policy Program Director at the Grattan Institute, and he's been thinking about super for quite a while. Brendan, let's start with the change. What's about to happen?
Well, the big change in superannuation is that the rate of compulsory super contributions that employers are required to put into their workers' account is about to go from 10% to 10.5% of workers' wages from 1 July. And that's part of a process that is lifting the rate of compulsory super from 9.5% through to 12% by 1 July 2025.
What difference will that make? I mean, it sounds obvious it's going to give people bigger super balances.
That's right. So the big obvious effect is it'll increase someone's super. So if you have larger contributions going in, they'll accumulate over a long period of time. The returns on those will compound and you'll get a larger superannuation balance at retirement. But the question we should always ask ourselves is, what is this actually going to do to people's retirement incomes? Because that's really what super is ultimately all about, and what the retirement income system, which is super and the age pension, is about. And for high income earners and very low income earners, it will boost their retirement incomes by quite a bit, because they'll get extra super. Low-income earners are already on the full age pension, which is means-tested. High-income earners don't tend to receive any age pension at all. But those in the middle, the sort of middle 40% of Australians by income, it won't actually boost their retirement income very much at all, because what they get in extra super contributions, which raises their balance at retirement, just means they'll actually get less age pension in retirement because of the age pension assets test.
Yeah, maybe it's an intended consequence, Brendan, but it sounds like an unintended consequence. So I'll come back to that. We are now a year into some reform of the superannuation system. Very briefly, what's changed and how effective has that change been?
So the big problem in super is that superannuation is not particularly efficient. People do tend to pay a lot for their superannuation in terms of managing the money, and there are a lot of underperforming funds. So reforms that the government, so the coalition government, one of their real big success stories, in my view, of their time in power, was that they have tried to sharpen the incentives for funds to do better by their members. So funds are now subject to an underperformance test. So they are assessed based on the offering that they make, where they invest that money, against a benchmark portfolio that reflects the sort of risk return profile of that fund, that product. And if they fail to meet the benchmark set by that benchmark return profile by more than 0.5% of a or percentage point each year over an 8-year period, then if they fail it once, they have to write to their members and let them know that they failed. If they fail it twice, they can't accept any new members until their performance improved. We haven't got to the 2-year mark yet, but there were 13 products that failed that had something like 1 million members in them. Of those, I think 9 of the 13 are already in the process or have merged, and the others have tended to reduce their fees, which is kind of what the purpose was to try to improve the performance of the system by reducing costs, because if you have lower fees and you get the same outcomes, that's the definition of a productivity improvement, and that compounds and gives a massive increase in people's retirement incomes in the long term.
So I want to go back to this rise in the super guarantee on its way, as you said, to 12% by 2025. There has been some debate about this, so I'm going to ask you directly, is raising it a good idea?
It really depends on where those extra super contributions come from. So who pays for them? Because look, if it just came from firms, it was just extra money for employees, then, you know, I'd be pretty sympathetic that it's a good thing for employees, because they're kind of getting something for nothing, although there's always the risk that if the employer has to pay more, that they end up employing less staff. But what we tend to find is that super does come as a trade-off to wages. So when you raise the rate of compulsory super, our work shows that wages growth for those workers tends to be much slower over the 2 or 3 year period where the super increase comes in. And so roughly 80% of it comes from slower wages growth for workers within 2 or 3 years. And there's good reasons to expect the trade-off is more like 1-for-1 in the long term. So given it is a trade-off to wages, is it a good idea to increase super for a lot of people? The answer is, quite frankly, no. And the reason is that a lot of people are already saving enough for retirement, and low-income earners, you know, arguably saving through super more than they should. Because the purpose of defaults like the rate of compulsory super is to make sure that the typical person saves enough for retirement. It's about overcoming these behavioural biases where people won't save enough. If you force people to save too much, which comes at the cost of lower income during their working life when they're raising kids, there's, you know, trying to study, doing all those things that boost their human capital and raise their productive potential in the long run, when they've actually got probably more expenditure pressures on them when kids are at school, it's hard for them to undo that process if they're forced to save too much, if you raise the compulsory super rate too high. Whereas if we're not forcing them to save enough, people can always add more contributions on top. And so, you know, what is enough? Well, enough is roughly having the same living standard in retirement as what you have while working. And what our work has shown, what the government's retirement income review that was run by former senior public servant Michael Callaghan showed, that the average person can expect to replace close to 90% of their pre-retirement post-tax earnings. So it's not clear that we need to raise compulsory super to raise retirement incomes, because they already look like they're doing their job. Now, Richard, the other issue with super is if you're going to increase the rate of compulsory super, it actually costs the budget a lot of money. In fact, it will cost the budget more in extra superannuation tax breaks than what it will save in age pension spending. And modelling done for the Retirement Income Review showed that the costs of the tax breaks exceed the pension spending, the savings, until 2055. So what you end up with is a system where we raise super, middle-income earners in particular give up their wages,
yeah,
get more super. The government then takes that extra money off them by reducing their age pension spending. But it still costs the taxpayer money, because those high-income earners get the extra super, get enormous tax breaks on that super, don't lose any age pension. And so the net result is high super will cost the budget for at least the next four decades and increase income inequality and wealth inequality in Australia.
I don't think that would have been the intention. We're talking about super this week in particular because it's 30 years old. It's a proper grown-up. Has it worked the way it was intended?
I would say, Richard, that super is probably a bit like that moody teenager. It's still going through some growing pains, but it's kind of getting there, and it's getting pretty close to adulthood. So it depends what you think the purpose is. You know, I tend to think the purpose of super is to boost people's retirement incomes so that they save enough for their retirement. And look, that has happened. That said, there are some things I think if we had our time again, we would definitely do differently. I think the original mistake was to set up a system where the whole point was that people aren't saving enough for their future because they don't think about it. But then to basically default people into super funds that are privately run, although the industry funds are not for profit, and expect that competition would make the market competitive. I think this is probably a good example of the idea that markets would work very efficiently and that people would be informed consumers. And I think what we've seen since is that it doesn't work anywhere near the way we hoped.
No, because unless you're a very unusual person, say you're 25, say you're 35 and you've got super going away, that's all down the track. That's something that you're going to get to at some point when you're old, but you're not thinking about it at all.
No, that's right. That's why we set up the system. So why would I spend a bunch of time in my busy life thinking about something that's not going to affect me for four decades, where we know financial literacy is low and is quite hard to improve, and we know that the main emotion people associate with retirement is fear, so they don't want to think about it. And so we shouldn't be surprised that the system hasn't been very efficient. There are far too many funds. We are spending something like $30 billion, $35 billion a year running the system. There's too little competition between members.
All right. So what would you change if you could, Brendan?
So the underperformance test is a start, but it really only addresses the worst performing funds. It doesn't do enough to encourage the median fund to improve its performance. So there's kind of two ways you can do it. The first thing I would do is I would try to implement the Productivity Commission had a recommendation to create a top 10 best in show list of funds, which would be how you would allocate new workers into the workforce. Would be allocated into one of these top 10 funds. And that really would work well, because the other reform that came in recently, Richard, that I didn't mention before, is people are now stapled to their fund. The first fund that they get is the fund that follows them as they change jobs. So it gets rid of this problem of people starting a new job, getting a new super account, never consolidating the old one.
Yeah.
Now, that would be the thing I would do because that's what the Productivity Commission recommended, and I think it's worth giving it a shot. If you don't like that idea, there is an alternative, which is the government actually establishes a national default fund. That's an approach that's been taken, you know, in, say, Sweden, and it's an approach that, you know, you're seeing some of that play out in the UK as well. You had to opt out of this fund. So you instantly opted in as a new workforce entrant. If you don't opt out and choose an existing fund, then you stay with the default. It would get huge economies of scale, which is what we see overseas, and it certainly wouldn't cost $30 billion a year to run.
Now, those are fundamental, structural, and I have to say, probably unlikely reforms. What about something more around the edges, but still important? The way super is taxed, would you make changes there?
Yeah, I think the way we tax superannuation, it's not sustainable in the world where we have the long-term budget pressures that we face. It's not particularly fair. Half the tax breaks go to the top 20% of income earners. And it is inconsistent with, I think, the purposes of super, because you're giving very large tax breaks to people that are already saving enough for retirement. So the number one thing you would do is, at the moment, as soon as you turn 60, if you've got a balance of less than $1.7 million, you pay no tax at all on your earnings. So this is your dividends on your BHP shares for the rest of your life. What I would do is basically tax those earnings for retirees at 15%, the same rules that apply for those that are still working in what we call the accumulation phase. That would raise several billion dollars that you could use to do lots of things, particularly at aged care. You could also reduce the amount of contributions that receive tax concessions going into the system. So when you make contributions to super, anything up to $25,000 of contributions is only taxed at 15% for most people, rather than their marginal tax rate of 32, 37, 45%. So you could reduce those contributions. We've suggested $15,000 a year rather than 25. And the easiest one, given we're in a world, Richard, where it's pretty hard to imagine the government adopting these reforms in the very short term, would be just to cap the total balances that are in super. Because anything above, say, $2 million per person looks a lot like tax planning and estate planning to me. And that would deal with the legacy issue you have, which was caused by, you know, the governments of John Howard and Peter Costello, that allowed people to have $100 million in super. And they are paying 15% tax on it rather than their marginal rate. And that is costing the federal government enormous amounts of money. And there's no way you can say that is about the purposes of super.
No,
it is just about estate planning.
So are there any signs that the new government might be open to any of this?
So far the government's been pretty tight-lipped, given that they did run on a platform that was pretty careful when it came to tax changes. They didn't rule out super tax changes, but I think they'll be relatively cautious there. I think for a sign of what's to come, you're actually better off listening to the Treasury Secretary, Stephen Kennedy, who gave a speech basically outlining that the budget is in worse shape and there's a long-term budget problem where spending has risen on aged care, the NDIS. Now we're going to have a lot more on defence. And taxes haven't kept up. And the best way to bridge that gap, to close that structural budget deficit, is things like super. It's things like the capital gains tax. It's the kind of loopholes in the tax system. There aren't big economic costs to reducing these loopholes. They would be progressive. And ultimately, if we want to balance the budget or have the budget on a sustainable footing, we're going to have to tackle some of these issues, whether it's next year, in 2 years' time, after the next election. A government is going to have to deal with this issue.
Brendan Coates from the Grattan Institute. One of the big changes brought about by the pandemic has been governments stepping up. In Australia, they spend a lot of money to try to ensure that families, businesses and individuals would survive. It required massive borrowings and was an about-face on a decade of labelling debt and deficits as a very bad thing. So is there an argument to keep some of those policies in which governments intervene to create fairer markets and a fairer society? Rosalind Dixon and Richard Holden believe there is. And the two University of New South Wales professors have written a book to plot a course, From Free to Fair Markets, Liberalism After COVID-19. Rosalind, you talk about democratic liberalism. What do you mean by that?
Democratic liberalism takes the voices of people seriously and puts them into making key decisions. And obviously it also has a fundamental commitment to equality and dignity for all citizens. But it translates into four very specific principles about the role of markets. The first of all is that states have a role in guaranteeing, not always providing, but guaranteeing that whatever market outcomes may occur, that everyone is guaranteed access to a dignified social minimum. And we can't let the vagaries of the market detract from that. The second principle is that we need to be committed to equality, not just adequacy, but equality for certain relative goods like education, life-preserving healthcare, and proximate decent housing. Thirdly, that we need to see markets as serving consumers and workers, not businesses, and therefore tame corporate and exercises of monopoly power that damage consumers and workers. And fourthly, deal with externalities or costs to society that are not considered by parties to particular transactions.
The book feels to me like it's aimed in a way more at the US than it is here. And Australia is, in fact, the example that you push forward as kind of further down that path than the US, which I think some Australians would be surprised. They'd say, hey, we've got all of these problems here. You're calling for a bigger role for governments and a move away from really the movement that has guided what Western governments do for 35 years or so.
Well, I think that's right. We're quite proud of Australia, but we've also spent a decade or so living in the United States. So we see sort of both parts of that. And I think the United States and other countries have some things to learn from Australia. And we talk about that, particularly when it comes to things like the healthcare system, for instance. But that's right. We acknowledge the problems with neoliberalism. I don't think that's a hugely controversial debate. But the question really for us is how can we respond to the challenges of things like inequality, automation, and climate change without giving up on economic efficiency and individual choice. And that's the kind of path we try and chart in the book.
In what ways is Australia a fairer example?
The healthcare system is perhaps the strongest example that we draw on explicitly in the book. And there's obviously a lot of tension within the Australian system between the three parts, which are private insurance, Medicare, and individual co-pays. And it's not perfect at the moment, but we think it's a sustainable and attractive model because the underpinning of it is a universal baseline level of care through Medicare that everyone relies on, everyone benefits from, and where there's buy-in to making sure that it's decent and adequate and that it provides actual equal chances of life-saving treatment, and that private insurance is meant to be an add-on for comfort and convenience, not for the chance of life-preserving care. And we think that's a really attractive model that in the US at least could cut through this stark divide between a private insurance for some model and a single payer for all. But we also suggest Australia has some implicit models that we as a country haven't even yet come to terms with. There's been such a divided debate about work for the dole and unemployment benefits that we think we're missing the chance to see an early version in Australia of a jobs guarantee through our, you know, dole system. And Newstart's too low. It needs to be raised. And we need to overlay the idea of work for the dole with a much more positive version of work that has social meaning and social value and possibilities for advancement.
Right, okay. And I can see that Australia and America are very different places. But just that universal guarantee thing about healthcare, I was interested, Richard, that you talk about and consider this idea of universal basic income, but come to the conclusion that it's not really for a country like Australia or indeed a country like America.
Well, that's right. So for a country like Australia or America, if you thought about what would be a livable basic income, you know, a barely livable basic income, and then make that universal, you get to more than the entire federal budget very, very quickly. And so it's really not a financially viable policy option. Now, that need not necessarily be the case in some countries in the global south. And there have been some really interesting experiments in places like Kenya and elsewhere where it looks like, you know, it might be a more feasible option. But I think the other thing that we point out about it, and many others have made this point as well, is there are other concerns with a UBI. You know, a job is about more than just a paycheck. It's about community. It's about a sense of purpose and so on. And I think there's that aspect to it as well.
But when you talk about the minimum wage, you have these essential building blocks of what we ought to be doing. And one of them is a significant increase to the minimum wage. That's, of course, been in the news here. But really, you are talking about a country like America here.
That's right. We're talking about a country like America where, you know, the so-called fight for 15, a $15 federal minimum wage would get you a little bit closer in purchasing power terms to the Australian minimum wage. So again, Australia's not perfect, but Australia's a lot further along some of these dimensions than a country like the United States.
And Richard, on that dimension, I think one of the things we would say is that for a country like Australia, where in the last federal election campaign, the only debate about wages was about the minimum wage, we should be more creative. And we maybe need to engage in sort of reverse borrowing from the United States, which has had an earned income tax credit for many years, not a very big one compared to what we advocate. But there are lots of ways governments can come in and supplement low wages that have more likelihood of boosting employment and wage growth than simply using the tool of the minimum wage. We support generous minimum wage, you know, policies, but there is some trade-off with employment, and so one has to be alive to the other ways in which we can boost real wage improvements for low-income workers.
So what are some of those other ways then?
Well, one of them I've mentioned, this idea that essentially instead of paying tax to the government when you're on a low income, you get a tax credit for a certain amount of income earned, not just a tax-free threshold, but an actual tax credit. And we also propose the idea that we should be looking at ways to subsidise wages in certain areas of Australia where there are high levels of unemployment due to changing patterns in globalisation and industries. And thirdly, and perhaps most controversially, the idea that we should be giving more equity forms of compensation to workers. The famous French economist Thomas Piketty has documented how the returns to capital are rising at higher rates than the returns to labour income. Mm-hmm. And that just means we need to spread capital around. And people used to do that through the housing market. It's much harder for people to get into housing. We need to find ways to give ordinary workers access to the upsides of capital growth. And that could be the kind of incentive schemes that CEOs have, but for the ordinary worker.
Yeah, CEOs and some of the other dwellers on the top floors get this access to equity schemes, but most people don't. And I do think that's a really interesting idea. Richard, we touched before on the healthcare system. I'm struck by the fact that this model of a kind of public baseline, you in the book extend it to other areas too, like providing childcare, for example.
Yeah, that's exactly right. One of the things we think you could do is take that idea of a baseline that no one is allowed to fall below and extend it to things like childcare and basic leave benefits, or maybe holiday leave, sick leave, parental leave for all workers. And so I think one of the things that the pandemic really brought home to a lot of people is that everyone needs to be able to be sick sometimes. Everyone needs to be able to deal with a school closure or taking care of their kids or taking care of an elderly relative. And of course, in certain jobs, that's provided for. But as the economy shifts, and this could be the gig economy or people who own small businesses, those things aren't as readily available. And saying, look, where the private sector already provides that or the public sector already provides that, that's taken care of, but that we should provide some baseline level of those sorts of leave provisions for everyone, regardless of their employment status.
Mm. One area, Richard, where Australia has not been an exemplar is in tackling climate change. I don't have to tell you about that. I think you and I have talked about it before. You write about the pros and cons of alternatives to a carbon tax, but when it comes down to it, you basically say it's the best option.
Well, it's the best policy with a twist. So our twist is to turn it into a carbon dividend. This is something that's been advocated in the US, and we have a version for Australia, but basically says take all the proceeds of the carbon tax and return them pari passu to each member of the public. And that would be something that has an inbuilt progressivism to it. There's an advantage to that in terms of making at least half, probably closer to 70% of the population, better off on net. But the bottom line is, if we're going to tackle climate change one way or another, there is going to have to be a price on carbon. If you want people to do something less of something, you need to tax it. And if you want people to do something more of something, then you need to subsidise it. And that's what a carbon tax does, whether that's in the form of a very explicit carbon tax matched with a dividend, whether it's through something like the safeguard mechanism and that being expanded. If we want to tackle climate change, you have to put a price on carbon.
It would also raise some revenue. I'm interested, and I don't mind actually which of you takes this one, but how to pay for these policy reforms? What are some of the other ways of raising revenue without governments having to borrow more? Bear in mind, of course, we've borrowed a lot now, or print more money?
Well, Richard, I'll take the first part of it. We have, I mean, a number of points about how to squeeze more out of the existing system, but the two key additional sources of revenue are not printing money and not having an infinite willingness to borrow, although we do note there's more capacity in the system to borrow. The first is to take this logic that Richard has just explained of the carbon dividend and do something quite similar, but a flip in a way for the GST. So we propose what we call a progressive GST, the idea of increasing and expanding the GST to, you know, cover all those items that all those years back we debated, and saying people should get a GST-free threshold. And so if you use the payment system and give people, you know, $5,000, $10,000 exemption from GST, they can use it on the fresh fruit or on their medical products or schooling or whatever, but everything's subject to it. And the net effect of that is, because higher income people spend more money, they'll pay more GST. Lower income people, that GST threshold will be more powerful for them. So at the heart of all of these policies is an idea about how do we twin efficiency and equity. Mm. And that's one of our ideas. Richard will talk about capital taxes, which is the other big one.
Mm. Go ahead.
Yes, it's important that we not think that there's sort of free money here, which is there's a reason why capital gains or capital income is taxed at less than ordinary income, labour income. And that's because you have to earn the capital that you're going to invest as labour income and pay tax on it before you go and invest it and then earn, you know, a dividend or a capital gain through, say, share ownership or through a property or other things. So there's always a reason for avoiding double taxation and therefore wanting to have it be a bit lower. The question is how much lower. Right now we give a 50% discount in terms of the capital gains rate. So in Australia, the top, you know, capital gains tax rates in the low 20%. We could imagine that going closer to the ordinary income tax rate than to zero. So, you know, maybe that discount should be pruned back. The Labor Party had a policy similar to that a couple of elections ago, not all the way, but just prune that back a little bit. And that could generate significant revenue.
What about other things like estate or an inheritance tax or dare I say it, a windfall tax on some of our natural resources?
Two quick things on that. You know, we're negative about the idea of an estate tax for the reason that it is further double taxation, and it's better to deal with things through the tax system in the ordinary way rather than trying to double tax after people have passed away. And then in terms of a super profits tax or a mineral resources tax, I can't believe I'm saying this as an economist, but it's a good idea in theory that doesn't work in practice. And the reason it doesn't is because it requires that taxation authority to know an awful lot of stuff that the companies know but that the tax authority doesn't know. And we've seen a live example of this, the petroleum resource rent tax, which needs to allow for depreciation and things like that, has been completely gamed by the companies.
Totally.
Basically, nobody pays any of that and they're proud of it. But we could get a lot smarter on mineral resources through the good old royalties tax, and that's something that we've talked about in the past.
We have. Professor Richard Holden and Professor Rosalind Dixon, both at the University of New South Wales. Their book is From Free to Fair Markets, Liberalism After COVID-19. That's it for now. The Money's produced by Kate McDonald. Our sound engineer is Roy Huberman. I'm Richard Adey.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.